Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network on tour, live from Charleston Wine and Food. My name's Kat Johnson, and we are broadcasting live today from the Le Creuset podcast studio at the Culinary Village of Charleston Wine and Food. Make sure that you go to heritageradionetwork.org/charleston2019 and see our full interview lineup. And tune in all day today until 5 p.m. We're going to have interviews until then. Coming up next is very exciting. We're going to have some Le Creuset friends coming to talk to us, Tiffany Theisen, as well as Nate Collier from Le Creuset. So stay tuned for that. As you can probably guess, Le Creuset is supporting our content this weekend, as well as our friends at the Julia Child Foundation, and we're so grateful for them for making our content possible. Okay, this is one of my most highly anticipated conversations of the weekend. We are joined by Robert Stelling. Welcome, Robert.
Hello, hello.
And the Lee brothers, Matt and Ted Lee. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thanks, Kat.
So, talk to all three of them. Robert has been on our Charleston Wine and Food coverage 3 years in a row now. So we've covered some, covered a lot of ground with Robert. I spoke to the Lee brothers at Fireflower and Fork in Richmond, Virginia last fall, which was a really fun chat. So I highly encourage you to go listen to interviews we've done in the past. And now we want to jump into some pretty specific conversations. Guys, let's start with the event that you all did together about a month ago. Right in the same square, right? Was it in Marion Square?
Yes, it was on the other side, the west side, under a tent, just like this one. And it was a food demo, a very traditional food demo thing, the kind you used to see in festivals like this, you know, 10 years ago. The context was this huge, like bigger than this one, I think, wildlife festival. 40,000 people, all really grooving on dogs and conservation to varying degrees. And
wildlife art, like decoys.
Paintings of ducks on a log.
Camouflage.
You need a couple of those for
camouflage.
A lot of camo. It's a really interesting festival then that it's kind of like the Field and Stream crowd meets the Garden and Gun crowd meets Duck Dynasty.
Ooh, are there a lot of beards?
A lot of beards and camo.
A lot of camo, and just a ton of great people from throughout the South. And it's a festival that's been running for at least 20 years. Yeah. So older than this Food and Wine Festival, and just very well established in the area. You know, people put it on their calendars a year out. Mm. But what's exciting is that 2 years ago, we were handed the reins of the food demo tent. You know, the one corner of the whole festival devoted to food, Ted and I got to pick the chefs and farmers and producers that we put on stage over a 3-day weekend, 18 hours. And you know, Robert's always top of our list.
Ours too.
Oh, thank you.
He almost always says no.
Yeah.
And this year
is a tough get.
We're so honored that you join us, Robert.
I didn't say yes this year. My daughter said yes.
Yeah, tell us about it.
So we used
that's
his,
how we get to him through Carson.
The soft underside.
Carson is getting into babysitting, and I have three little boys. And she came over to babysit on a couple of occasions, and I just started this conversation about what would it take to get your dad on stage, and she said, "Well, you know, I'm studying the theatrical arts in high school, and so, you know, this is a natural for me." And I said, "Well, gosh, we really love having family teams up on stage. Never a solo chef on stage. You never want to do that, certainly not for an hour." But anyhow, it wrote itself. It was perfect. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah. Well, she has the professional training, so it was very helpful.
You have different professional trainings.
Yes, but they, you know, the subsets kind of, you know, intersected. So
yes.
It was
so
nice to share that moment with her.
So what was the demo that you did?
We demoed shad roe, which is a local delicacy that's in season right now. And it was fun to do. It's kind of offbeat and not very Instagrammable. So it was a lot of fun to do.
It's highly Instagrammable. It looks so gory. When it's raw, it's got like veins, like, you know, wrapping around it. It looks like an organ that you're not quite sure what it is. It could be human. And it's
very red. It's like the deepest red you can get before you get to a gemstone.
Yeah, can you like describe it a little bit more too, if people have a connotation in their mind about roe, like caviar that you get from Russ and Daughters, how does it differ from that?
It's like torpedo shaped, but two of them bound together. It looks like a sausage, kind of.
Yeah.
Tapered
or
sausage.
A kidney with veins on it. Squished out kidney.
And
with
it's
veins
filled with very small eggs. It's don't visualize salmon roe.
Yeah,
those,
they're
like,
much smaller.
Big poppers. These are tiny micro eggs, and so it when you can almost be fooled into thinking it's like flesh or liver or something.
Actually, Robert, how heavy is like an average shad roe?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. It's been years since
I've
weighed them. Probably
right.
Is it like 8 ounces?
Half a set's probably about 3.5-4 ounces maybe.
Yeah.
So like 6-7 8 ounces.
And flavor wise, it's very rich. You know, it's very. How would
but
you
it's
describe
not fishy,
the flavor,
it's not
Robert?
Like salmon eggs. It has more neutral.
Yeah.
Fish egg kind of approach.
It's really rich, but it's a delicate fishiness. And the texture has just enough crunch to it still, all the little eggs and stuff. So
well,
it's
when y'all
soft
were,
and kind of grainy at the same time. So
as he was sautéing it in the pan on stage a few weeks ago, some of the eggs that get loose will get to a stage where they kind of pop like popcorn and splatter grease and stuff, and it got exciting.
The cooks love that at the restaurant. They have to wear long sleeves during shad roe season.
That's so fun.
But it's cool. What was cool and what's always cool about doing collaborations with Robert is that he always has great ideas for familiar ingredients. I mean, this is something that we've known for a long time, because you opened your restaurant in 96 or 90?
Yeah, 96.
96.
23 years.
And remember, we did the chef column for the New York Times with you in maybe 2002 or so. And it was four different columns, four different recipes, and they are super original uses of ingredients you're familiar with. Like creamed collards was one of the recipes. Each column was devoted to a recipe, and it was like creamed collards, and it was like the first time anyone had thought of that. I mean, probably not, but it for a mainstream audience,
it was
yes.
Fresh.
It was fresh, new idea. There was another cool shrimp and okra beignet where, like, you know the sliminess of okra that everyone hates? He was kind of like using that in the beignet, like that sliminess becomes the batter.
When it hits the fryer,
and
it gets
this
egg yolk sort of crispiness.
It gets
egg white.
Yeah,
egg white.
So it's like
crispiness.
Slime's the starch, and
yeah,
so
the slime
you use that
becomes
as a binder.
The starch. And so that's the kind of thing we look to Robert for, these like genius, not like, you know, this isn't tweezer food. This is like easy food you can make in your home, but blows your mind because you've never encountered it.
It's like those hacks. Like, everyone likes to use the term hack now. It's like something that seems sort of obvious, but not everyone can come up with it.
So he did that with the shad, too, right?
Yeah.
Because he, you know...
What you cook up?
Egg salad.
Egg salad. Oh. Shad egg salad.
A brunchy scramble, basically.
Yeah. The scrambled... The bacon. Yeah, we're doing that for the festival this weekend. So
really?
Yeah?
All weekend cool. At the restaurant. So
yeah.
Well, you know always stop in. So
yep,
we'll see you there.
Yep.
Well, it's an exciting time of year because you have to understand that the shad fish is the world's largest herring species. It's big and it's oily.
Okay, so I was going to ask because like the shad scramble, like when I think of like caviar and eggs, I do kind of go to like Russ and Daughters, sort of, it's sort of Jewish, and then making it that it's a herring kind of makes a little bit of sense.
I mean, there's a lot of work to be done in this realm, like pickling shad and stuff, right, Robert? I mean, the flesh is considered garbage because everyone's so fixated on the roe. I think Charleston is probably the only place up and down the eastern seaboard where the shad migrate and spawn, where the actual fish itself is consumed and sold in fish markets and valued. It's very bony, so it takes a lot of labor to debone it and to make it sort of home-friendly. But it has a lot of value because it's so beautifully oily. It takes salt and smoke really well. It goes under a broiler beautifully, and the skin blisters and browns and bubbles. And You can do some great things with it, and it's probably a dollar a pound. They're giving it away. And it looks like farmed salmon raw. It has that level of veining in it, of fat. It's like, you know, almost like a zebra stripe.
Traditionally, they would plank roast it by the riverside, big fires, and just nail the shad to the planks and stick them in the sand and let them roast right next to the fire and get a little smoky, but it would cook it really well done so that you could eat it, bones and everything, so you didn't have to bone it that way. No.
This is a native food. I mean, it's indigenous to this region. It goes all the way up the coast. The Hudson River has a shad run that'll be in like another month or so. There's some beautiful old archival photographs of shad fishermen in the Hudson River with the George Washington Bridge as a background.
I want to hear about, there were two recipes that he made. He did like a shad egg scramble, and then it was two sort of riffs on eggs and eggs, and then there was a shad egg salad. And I'm just curious, like, from you're very creative, and it, you know, you sort of make connections between things that people otherwise wouldn't. Where does an idea like shad roe egg salad come from?
You know, working in Charleston and working with the pantry here, you kind of have a limited number of vegetables. Kind of, I always say it's the same dozen vegetables or so, eggplant, okra, and everything. But, you know, I've been at it for 23 years, so, you know, I kind of really drill down the same place for a while, and sometimes those kind of really basic, simple ideas, you know, once you get a lot of stuff stripped away and you've got building blocks and you're like, oh, I can stack it this way. You know, it's like, here's eggs, here's shad. They go together well. Here's a, you know, egg salad. Here's a, you know, here's a deviled egg. And you just kind of keep going with that.
So it comes out of almost like a boredom or frustration with the conventional ways in which certain ingredients are deployed. Right. I mean,
well, you know, we it's like, as what else chefs can I today, do there's with- so much, you know, available to us, and you know, you just keep bringing in new stuff all the time. You never really get to explore, mm-hmm. you know, something. Yeah, you know, when you get really bored with it, then you're coming up, you know, then you come up with new ideas, you know.
Like limitation breeds creativity.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that are different. You know, you know, I can think to add something, you know, the latest trendy ingredient to everything, or you know, right. I can think about what these, you know, traditions are and why, you know, why things grow together here and they complement each other and use those.
Do these ideas come to you in the middle of the night or
the
test kitchen?
Mostly in the test kitchen. Uh-huh. Yeah. You know, I usually have to face a brunch menu every week, and that's usually when, you know, I plan
innovation
out.
Strikes.
Yeah. I always say there's like, 3 days to the week, brunch, the day after brunch, and the day before brunch.
What's the weirdest mimosa you've ever served at your restaurant?
I did a prickly pear cactus mimosa once. Served it at the restaurant, but we did it for some events that were.
It's got good
cool.
color.
Great color.
Yeah. It was Instagram.
I'm super bummed because our prickly pear harvest point was the ornamental front scape of a bank parking lot
on Highway
61. In West Ashley on Highway 61, and they completely tore it out. So we don't get prickly pear anymore.
Talk a little bit more about that, because you guys do a lot of like foraging around Charleston, and you find some things in some
pretty
strange
places. It's so funny
because
we don't call it foraging; we just like look over our shoulders and
food.
Just get it.
It's finding.
It's finding. It's
no one should
it's pre-dumpster diving.
It's free stuff.
No one should spend cash money for rosemary in this town.
That's
like
so true.
There's
out
too much
the
rosemary everywhere.
In so many places.
But there, you know, on private property, there's a lot of, like, we just had lunch with our friend Anne the other day, and her grapefruit tree is producing so much fruit right now, she can't give it away. She literally has, like, buckets on her doorstep, and she's calling everyone she knows saying, come pick up grapefruits, because if she doesn't pick it, it drops on the ground, her dog eats it, comes in the house, and vomits it on the rug.
Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that, right?
It's heavy with fruit, like yellow grapefruit. I don't know variety. It's some, you know, yard variety. The tree's probably 20 years old, and it simultaneously got last year's season's fruit, and it's blooming now. So it smells like this tropical garden.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, fruit trees in Charleston Gardens, but so many of them aren't native and stuff, you know.
Right. There's pomegranates.
Yeah. I got really excited about persimmons.
Right.
Went
citrus
running
is
over
not
there
native.
One time to find out. They were Japanese. I was like, oh, thanks.
Yeah, native persimmons are few. It's interesting to untangle, like, what is native and what the Kusabo tribes of this region might have worked with 400 or 500, 600 years ago. It's shad, of course, right? But the native persimmons are super tart and bitter and small. And the ones that are prevalent in the markets today are giant. Bloated and giant and watery and don't really have a lot of bite to them. But there are things like that most people would miss or consider a weed, like smilax vine, whose tender shoots like taste like a better version of asparagus, and grow on the sand dunes and have a little bit of salt to them and like are really fantastic. But they'd never make it to a restaurant setting because of the labor involved in selecting for the tender shoots and just scrambling around the dunes.
Yeah, you have to be careful where the you can go on the dunes.
True.
Yeah. True.
Well, that kind of makes me think of, this is a bit of a tangent, but thinking of someone scrambling around dunes to forage ingredients that aren't common on menus, like, makes me think of Noma and how Rene Redzepi was able to do that and bring a lot of attention to certain ingredients that were not common. Do you think that a restaurant or a chef like that could exist in Charleston doing similar things, or would they run into too many private property, government regulations? You can't do that.
Well, if you get a chef doing that kind of activity, inevitably the next step is to encourage some entrepreneurial, free-thinking young farmer to cultivate that thing or to create an arena where it could be done on a sustainable level. I'm not concerned about the gold rush of smilax causing the dunes to be stripped. Like,
yeah.
It's the work is too hard and the value is just not that great.
Yeah. I think...
Which is fortunate.
I've never been to Noma, so I can't speak from experience, but my sense is, like, I'm not sure that we have a restaurant here that has that mission and that heat-seekingness that, I mean, isn't it? It's like $1,000 a head experience.
Right.
And that piece doesn't really exist here because I don't think it makes sense in the context of this place. You know, I mean, I think it makes
Which
sense
is a
in
beach
Copenhagen.
Town, a leisure town.
I mean, we're a beach town, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to the beach tonight.
I think it would be
good.
Tough. You know, just there would be a lot of government regulations. You know, it's gotten a lot better, and the health department runs foraging classes and things like that now.
Oh, wow.
So.
Yes, there's a certification in mushroom foraging, and yeah,
that's
but it would still be a tough job to you know. Keep that going, although
and make
you know,
it legit.
Charleston has such a great growing season that you know you pretty much have stuff year round. Plus the ocean, so.
It's a super different climate.
One thing you also have to understand about the food world in Charleston is part of the genius is simply its position. We're at the southern limit of a lot of northern species, both botanically and in terms of fish, and we're at the northern limit of a lot of southern species. So you have mahi. And striped bass, and you have
stone crab,
bananas, banana trees growing. I have one in my backyard, and if we get a severe winter, it'll die back to the ground, but it'll still come up. And we have asparagus, which does slightly better in the north. So there's just a numerically greater array of possible ingredients for a chef to use that are fresh and in your backyard, and so that has its effect on the food scene.
You would be better doing a restaurant, sorry to take you off, but one based on cultural traditions than, you know, a food, you know, niche like, you know, a foraged food or something like that. You know, Charleston is such, you know, great history, and really that's what sells in this town, and that's what's special about it and what people come here for, you know.
Well, we do have to wrap up quickly, and this was far too short. But last question, rapid fire question.
We're far too long-winded.
No, never. Besides any of the amazing foods and ingredients we've mentioned so far, do each of you have another little-known Charleston ingredient that you would like to see more of on menus or that you think people should come to Charleston to try? Could be a trash fish, quote-unquote trash fish.
I mean, one thing that reigns supreme in this town, which I think people outside don't really understand, is sheep's head, the fish, the inshore fish, like that inhabits the tributaries and stuff, and saltwater fish that's super tasty. All it eats all day is shrimp and crab and oysters. It's like a robber. It like will invade the poor oyster shell that dares to open while it swims by, and so it has this very shellfishy sweet flavor, and yet no one really in New York understands what a sheep's head is unless they're way out on Long Island.
Robert?
I don't know. I think that they should be serving more shrimp personally, but there's a lot of shrimp on the menus. But
farm raised from Thailand?
Well, yeah, the local...
My favorite.
Wild caught.
You know, the local catch needs to be promoted, and it's such a beautiful resource. And, you know, it falls into a few dishes and doesn't get, you know, always as an appetizer and doesn't really get a lot of play, you know, outside of, you know, the ubiquitous shrimp and grits, which I serve a lot of. But, you know, I think that's a beautiful thing to sell. I'd love to see more of it on the menus.
I've been seeing a lot of pickled shrimp lately, which I'm a big fan of.
Yeah, pickled shrimp is great.
Yeah. Ted?
I'm going to go out there and say loquat, which I don't think is something you can get commercially. But it's something that's everywhere in this town. Loquats,
japonica or something. It's native.
Throwing out the Latin.
Those are the yellow ones?
Yeah, yes. The yellow ones. The yellow ones. And they're on the street. You can just put out a ladder and scrape them off the tree. Really easy to get. They don't have a lot of meat to them, but they have tremendous flavor. And if you find one that doesn't have flavor, just go to the next tree, because there's a lot of different varieties within the loquat, and I'm discovering which trees taste best. But it's kind of like the flavor. Imagine a cherry crossed with a tart green apple, and that's about what it tastes like.
Sounds
small
delicious.
Yellow flute the size of your thumb.
Awesome. Well, thanks to all of you for sitting down and talking about some of the ingredients and foodways of Charleston and the surrounding area that we should all know more about. I really appreciate it.
Thank you,
Kat.
Thank you. All right, thanks. This has been Matt and Ted Lee and Robert Stelling. I'm Kat Johnson. Thanks once again to Le Creuset and the Julia Child Foundation for making Heritage Radio Network on tour at Charleston Wine and Food possible. Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Listen to over 10,000 of our episodes at heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.